difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Keith Phipps
and Tasha Robinson.
We also have our special guest, Chicago critic and A12 Film Reviews founder Robert Daniels, back with us for the second part of our pairing. Robert, how has the week you've spent between episodes gone?
It's gone by in a flash, absolute flash. Yeah,
amazing. It's incredible how fast, for us too, very fast between episodes. On last week's show, we talked about Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger's A Matter of Life and Death, a fantasy romance about a man who cheats death in order to pursue a relationship with a woman he loves. That movie surely had a significant influence on the new Pixar film Soul, which is also about a man who goes missing from heaven's ledgers because he's anxious to get back to his life on Earth. Only in Soul, there's not much of a life to return to. Or at least there wasn't until the very day that Joe Gardner, voiced by Jamie Foxx, falls down an open manhole. When you first meet Joe, he's dragging his way through another day in the catacombs of the New York City public school system, where he works as a middle school music teacher. Despite the happy news that this long temporary job is now full-time, Joe still clings to his dream of being a jazz pianist, despite the many setbacks and rejections that have led him to a humbler position. Shortly after Joe finally catches his big break and successfully auditions to play alongside famed saxophonist Dorothea Williams, voiced by Angela Bassett, he falls victim to his own blissful absent-mindedness and dies. Rather than ride the escalator to the heavens, however, Joe does everything he can to get back to Earth and make the gig of his dreams. But first he has to pose as a mentor to one of the new souls who needs to pick up aspects of their personality before getting an Earth pass. His student of sorts is 22, voiced by Tina Fey, a jaded soul who has resisted every mentor and every opportunity to get her Earth pass. The two are an odd pair, but when Joe gets their souls back to New York City, with 22 in his old body, and Joe in the body of a therapy cat, they begin to discover what life is all about. Like the pleasures of Buy the Slice Pizza, or of rating and reviewing this podcast. We'll talk more about them after the break.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
No, it's the great before.
This is where new souls get their personalities, quirks, and interests before they go to Earth.
Meet 22.
I don't want to go to Earth.
Stop fighting this.
I don't want to.
Okay, look, I already know everything about Earth, and I don't want anything to do with it.
You're missing out on the joys of life, like pizza. I can't smell. We can't taste either.
All that stuff is in your body.
No smell, no taste.
Or touch. See?
Okay, I get it.
Wow. It's my life.
Is all this living really worth dying for?
You're still alive?
Can you help me get back?
No way!
There I am. What are we waiting for?
Wait, not me!
It's weird.
What is it?
151,000 souls go into the great beyond every day, and I count every single one of them. The counts.
So, generally speaking, of course, the first question, what did you think of Soul?
Oh, I dug it. I thought it was a good one. It's not, to me, up to the level of Inside Out, which is, I think, one of Pixar's masterpieces and Pete Docter's best film, but I've seen it twice now and enjoyed it both times.
Robert? What do you think?
I am decidedly very mixed on Soul.
Okay.
I think visually it's stunning. I have no problems with it visually. I think the first 30 minutes is you know, really good. I actually even think, you know, the end is really good. And I'm almost going to copy Tasha's argument, but I think everything in the middle is like, you know, problematic. Problematic is probably the word, is with the body switch narrative or trope. And then the idea of like Tina Fey kind of like coming very, very close to digital blackfacing. There's a lot in this film that, as much as it emotionally resonated with me, it just as equally infuriated me.
Okay. Tasha, what about you?
I've also seen this movie twice, and it played very differently for me the first time and the second time. The first time, I was really blown away by The Great Before, by the creativity of the visuals and the intensity of the colors and just all the design choices that went into it. And that whole middle section left me super, super cold. Just like, I was loving the grandeur of the film and the real human emotions of that first 30 minutes. And then suddenly we drop into like a giant slapstick routine with a wacky cat and whatnot. But the fact that the movie kind of loops back to humanity at the end, I think gave it a lot of strength that, like, I was starting to check out a little on goofy comedy routines, and then it pulled me back in. So watching it the second time, I felt like it actually felt like a stronger film to me. Like the sense of discovery and creativity and innovation wasn't as strong as it was the first time. It seemed almost a little more conventional in terms of some of the animation choices that it's making. But the humanity of it came through a lot more strongly for me on a second viewing. And the emotions of the last act in particular came through a lot more strongly for me. The first time I watched it, I immediately rewatched Inside Out, like just instantly. Wasn't planning to make that a double feature night, but it was almost a physical compulsion. It was so strong. And I thought the two films work really well together as a double feature. I agree with Keith that Inside Out is stronger, but I see where Doctor is going for in Soul. I think one of the most interesting things about Soul, and we can dig into this a little bit, is that it consciously upends. There are a bunch of things that are tropey that it does that could be very much going for emotional resonance, and Doctor consciously lets go of those things in favor of giving us maybe a more ambivalent ending and a more ambivalent look at life. And I feel like that's the less satisfying choice in a way, but the more daring and interesting and ambitious choice.
Yeah, I like the way this ends. It's weird to compare it to Inside Out. Like, this is, you know, Inside Out is about, you know, science and mind and psychology and draws on actual neuroscience to talk about, you know, how, you know, why we think the way we do and how our personalities get formed. And that movie just absolutely wrecks me emotionally. And this one's about spirituality and the big questions and you know, what life's really about. And this, to me, it's like, it's more of a chin scratcher. You know, it is more, it's not that it doesn't move me, but I have more of an emotional remove in the way I approach this movie than I do with what in theory ought to be the part, you know, no pun intended, ought to be the headier of the two.
Yeah, I mean, I really like this movie. I've had Pete Docter on the brain because I wrote a pretty long piece for The Ringer about his four films and the way he makes movies. And I kind of compared him to Charlie Kaufman as somebody who has this gift for creating these very elaborate metaphysical conceits in order to make very narrow and audacious and specific points about, you know, the nature of life in humanity. Because, I mean, if you think about, you know, something like Inside Out, the entire apparatus of that film exists to make the point that sadness is important, you know, really. It's an important part of our humanity and something that we should, certainly as parents, accept from our children as much as we, in our joy-like ways, want to make them happy all the time. And here, the key moment for me was when Joe has done all of this work to get back to Earth, get back to his body, to finally play the club show of his dreams, to have that club show go every bit as well as he expected it to have it be this incredible experience, and then to have the show end and to be outside and everybody's going home. And he's like, what now? And Dorothea says, you know, we'll come back and do it again tomorrow night. And it was such a profound moment for me because it's like, especially as somebody who got his dream job, you know, I mean, I had the dream job to write about film when I was 16 years old, and I achieved that dream. But then you think, is that all there is or something? Mm-hmm. Is there what is the actual purpose here? And so it's a very melancholy moment that also leads to, you know, a quite optimistic and cheering revelation about the real reason why you would want to come back to Earth, the real things that you ultimately treasure about living. And I found that very moving, and I think I wouldn't put it in top tier, I guess, Pixar. It's not my favorite of Doctor's films. It's not my favorite Pixar, but I think it's strong. And I think maybe you've identified sort of the weaker elements of the film, which would involve kind of the body switching, you know, some of the sillier elements of the film. I mean, some of which work, some of which don't, but I think the fundamental sentiment that's being expressed by this elaborate mechanism of a film is valid and moving one.
It's weird too. I mean, right? It just, you know, not to be reductive to one word, but it's a very strange film. It's a depiction of the afterlife and the whole Mystics Without Borders and all this stuff. It's fun and peculiar, and it's not afraid of being a fairly eccentric depiction of what lies beyond life as we know it. I do really love the ending too. I do love it's unresolved whether he goes on to a life as a jazz musician or if he sticks with teaching. And it's almost beside as the film would point out, it's almost beside the point. His spark and his passion aren't the same thing.
Which is an interesting point.
Also, Robert, you've seen this movie at least 3 times, right?
Yeah, 3 times.
Does watching it multiple times, like, did you have a similar experience where it played differently for you when you knew where some of these aspects were going?
You know, it's weird. So the first time I watched it, I remember being left cold. I remember, you know, that final act just not sitting well with me. But I couldn't put my finger on it. I just kept kind of sitting around, like, wondering, like, what did I just watch? And, you know, talk about this in more detail, but I was reading this book called Film Blackness, and the second chapter of it, the author, whose name I'm blanking on, talks about Chameleon Street, you know, which is a film about this black guy who's passing his different professions, you know, from doctor to lawyer to sports star, and it's based on a real person. And that's when I was like, oh, I think what the thing that's taking me out of this is that it feels like this is racial passing narrative. And then I rewatched it again, and it was weird because I rewatched it with that in mind. And the things that I didn't like about it, I could pinpoint it quicker. However, oddly enough, it emotionally resonated with me more the second time too. You know, that last act felt better to me. And then the third time, you know, I think it basically just kind of stayed the same. It's not a film that I absolutely hate. it's not there. It's definitely a film that, you know, I'm mixed on. And, you know, I believe this film kind of started out as a Tina Fey vehicle. And then, like, Kemp Powers kind of came in later and kind of put more of the jazz elements in it. And it sometimes has that feel as though Pete Docter kind of set up the traffic cones for Kemp Powers to drive around. But, like, you know, he's hitting them because he doesn't know where the traffic cones are, basically. And, yeah, it's sometimes it feels like the thing that it's going for with, you know, the body switch narrative and the racial passing, it's not something that they're consciously going for. It's something they're kind of unconsciously kind of bumping into. And it's never enough to be malicious or anything like that, but it's enough to give pause and, you know, to wonder, like, oh, well, I wish this hadn't began as a Tina Fey vehicle. I wish it'd been the other way around and began as kind of a Jamie Foxx vehicle, and then 22 got wheeled in afterwards, you know, trying to add this, you know, black element to this story that it begins. We can talk about this, whether 22 is a white character or not, but, you know, as kind of a, you know, a white story, I think it's so much harder than beginning as a black story and knowing where those pitfalls are and then adding kind of like the white element more to it.
Do you end up feeling like this is more 22's story, that like the rescue of 22 kind of subsumes the story about Joe?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it really, once they get down to Earth, you know, it really becomes 22's story, and it almost becomes where it's not really about Joe getting back to this gig. It's really about 22 finding her purpose. And in that journey to get to that point really puts Joe in this situation where he is kind of, I don't want to say the passive character in the film, but he very much is, like, you know, bending over backwards to placate the things that 22 needs in order to feel whole. And, you know, in that, I guess, that last act, one of the things I find a little bit grating is Joe becoming almost the villain and having to apologize for misunderstanding 22's intentions or even misunderstanding himself and what he wants in life. Yeah, it felt out of place for me. And yeah, it's maybe Joe's story for the first act, but after that, it's 22's.
I find that sometimes, I don't know if this is going to resonate for you or this is just a me thing, but like with a movie like Matter of Life and Death, I sometimes find that like either the intellectual elements work for me, like I like the structure of the story and the idea of it, but I think the emotional resonance of it as often doesn't work, or the other way around. Like the big in Matter of Life and Death, it might be more that like the big emotions work fine for me, but the way they're specifically executed, I keep thinking like this could have been done better. This could have been done more clearly. Do you have a sense for whether it's more like an emotional or intellectual response for you with Soul?
It's certainly, I think, a more intellectual response. I think emotionally it works. I think it's a very powerful draw to, you know, to ask what is our purpose in life is, and, you know, is purpose enough of a substance to get us through life? And I think it heads into that topic very well in a way that does resonate at its end. But the way that it gets there, the path that it charts intellectually, for me, it doesn't match the purity, you know, not to be reductive about it, but yeah, kind of like the purity of what it wants the ending to be of, like, you know, and kind of I even like the purity of even the construction of this world. You're right that we are all the same, that in the end we're all just looking to find the right portions of life that fulfill us.
Yeah, I feel like one of the reasons this just doesn't resonate on quite the same level as Inside Out is, like, Inside Out's climax, its big moment, centers on just an act of catharsis and recognition. Like, we've all felt sadness, we've all felt grief, we've all felt comfort, and it's just a really well realized moment. I kind of feel like the big emotional climax of Soul feels like somebody telling himself, my dream job wasn't all it was cracked up to be. And that's just sort of a hard lesson to take, you know?
That's kind of audacious, though.
I love the daring of it. But again, it makes it maybe not land emotionally for me as much. I love the montage, that the procedure where he sits down at the piano and basically plays a quarter of a bagel and a pizza crust and a Metro card and a lollipop. Just he plays a bunch of detritus. I really thought the movie was going to go in a direction of him realizing that his spark or his passion or his purpose or whatever you want to call it, the real one, wasn't playing in a jazz band. It was composing music to express his emotion.
I thought it was collecting garbage.
He's gone through all of these experiences and he has this moment of like pure creativity of like putting all of his feelings into his instrument. And it almost goes unremarked on. It becomes a tool to get him to another place to deal with 22's problems. And that's where I started feeling like Robert really kind of has a point there in terms of the narrative shift being a little bit of an issue, because kind of the moment that should be his biggest triumph, where he understands himself and who he is and what life is all about, just kind of turns into a vehicle to go rescue 22. That was the part of the movie that I wasn't really entirely down with, I think.
Yeah, see, I don't know. I always felt it was Joe's story. You know, even when it was about trying to find a purpose or a spark for 22, he was essentially reintroducing the world to himself through her. I mean, showing her New York, showing her the things about New York that he treasures, you know, was a way of him making crucial discoveries about himself and his own motives, his real motives for wanting to come back to Earth, more so than it was to send this, you know, quippy little soul on her way. To me it did feel mostly like Joe's story. I mean, though the Faye aspect of the movie is certainly, you know, the weakest for me, broadly speaking. I mean, I think it's almost a much more, it's much better as a serious film than as a comedy. it almost felt a little bit like Ratatouille in a way, of just kind of like of one character trying, kind of controlling the other, because they've I don't know. There's a lot of mixing and matching here of Pixar movies past, but it came together for me pretty well.
I also, this might be nitpicky, but I just never got this story working with Joe's profession, right? I like, oh, this is going to be the gig that changes his life, but like, it's so, he's been gigging his whole life. He's like a jazz musician. Like, he's not like so naive to, he shouldn't be, you know, so naive to think that like this really low stakes kind of one night kind of gig is like, oh, I'm going to be discovered or something like that, you know? And it feels like when they're outside the jazz club and he, you know, he's talking about, oh, you know, we're just going to play again tomorrow. Like, and he's like disappointed by that. I was like, well, yes, you're a musician. You gig. Like, I don't see why this is a surprise.
What did you think about Dorothea as a character? I love Angela Bassett so much. Just like the trope that she's fallen into of just the fierce woman who kind of comes across as the perpetual stern grandmother. Like, she's been doing that for 30 years now, and I've never not loved it. But I'm curious what you thought about its kind of translation into this grand dame of jazz, who's kind of like the gatekeeper, but also almost the conscience of the piece. She's got a very load-bearing role here. I'm wondering how it landed for you guys.
Fine. I'm trying to think what...
I mean, I think she's good, but I think you're right. It is a very familiar character. And you know, when you cast someone like Angela Bassett, you kind of expect to be a few more layers there. But I mean, she's good, though. And of course, the animation does a lot of work, too. She's a very fearsome gaze.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't read too much into her character. I mean, she's, you know, grandmother and auntie, you know, what, like... She's very much like the other women in Joe's life, the other stern women, like his mother, right? I think one of the other portions of Soul that I really wish we'd seen is, you know, we get this hint of this love interest that he might have, this, for, you know, this love interest that he's put kind of on the back burner, and we never see her, we never get any more sense other than 22, like, you should really pursue that, you know? And I'm like, the whole time I was like, narratively, like, yes, you should really pursue that, Pete Doctor. But it is very much like in keeping with the stuff that Angela Bassett has been doing recently, and I guess, like, in a sense, it is the, you know, looking for validation in your peers, you know, probably not the most fulfilling thing or route to take to have a somewhat healthy creative and personal life.
Well, I'm curious. I mean, obviously this has been sort of touted as the first Pixar with a black protagonist and maybe or a significant black character at all, which I was curious about how it functions for you as that, as if it reveals anything about Pixar and its blind spots, perhaps, or if there are aspects of black life that it understood well, or what where do you land?
I'm not trying to think. I'm just hung up on, like, is it really a first Pixar film with a significant black character in it? I can't think of another one.
It's interesting because I think there are scenes that do feel very familiar to me. Right, the barbershop scene was a scene that I will say the first time I watched it, it resonated with me, right? You know, it's such a lived in experience for black men to kind of have this open forum where, you know, you can say or express who you are without, you know, at least without judgment for people who don't understand you. There will be judgment though, but it was a thing that I felt less great about the second time around watching it, right? That there was, you know, 22, this character that's kind of like in the middle, you know, pontificating to these, you know, black characters who are, you know, on hand and knee, like listening to her in awe and amazement.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I think that's like the major, like, black center point, other than, you know, the warmth that Joe's mother shows to him, and that very much feels like a black motherly warmth, right? That comes through very well, I think. But yeah, I mean, I think the other portion about this is, and I don't know where I saw it. I saw it somewhere on Twitter, but I really am still waiting for a jazz movie that loves jazz. It feels like, you know, the fact that the kind of, I guess not, you know, but the moral of the story is like, well, you know, you being a jazz musician isn't all it's cracked up to be, Joe. You know, kind of like left a sour taste in my mouth. I'm like, no, like, you know, I think that there's a way to kind of explore Joe's love of jazz, of like, it's not just an obsession, but, you know, it is a portion of his being, and it is a way that he has in his life learned to express himself, and, you know, has maybe given him confidence, has maybe helped him through tough times and stuff. And it's, you know, for it to be an obsession, yes, obsessions can run away from you and turn into things that make us wandering in the astral plane as a weird cyclops monster. but you know, that, you know, the jazz in itself is, considering that it is kind of, has always been considered, you know, the black genre of, this is the thing that is, other than blues, that has charted the black experience in America, that I wish it had been handled a little bit more delicately, and other than, like, you know, kind of like thrown to the waste bin in a way.
I think you at least get a little bit of the love of the music prior to that. Within the scenes of the actual performance itself, and some of the scenes with him and the kid, you get a little bit of that. I mean, I'm with you, though. It's like, I'm tired of seeing, it's not maligned here, but I'm tired of seeing jazz so widely maligned when it's great. Backing up to an earlier question, we got Frozone. Just if Frozone counts as a major black character.
I forgot.
Major, though? I mean, he's a not completely insignificant character.
Has there been a Frozone, you know, spin-off, like, straight to video thing? There has to be. I guess there isn't, but there should be.
There really should be a short. We need a Frozone short.
I will say, with regard to the jazz, though, that when he plays and kind of, you know, and then it you know, elevates to the sort of the astral plane, the film does communicate, I think, quite well musically and visually and emotionally, the feeling of artistic collaboration and of locking into, you know, a particular bit of music or whatever it is that you're doing that feels transcendent, that you know, and that can almost only happen, that can, through collaborating with other people who are similarly gifted and can kind of push you to a place you've not been before. And so it does capture that feeling quite strongly, I think, even if, you know, ultimately jazz is not the reason that he wants to live, which is maybe a little bit more disappointing.
As to the barbershop scene, that is one of those intellectual emotional breaks for me, where I like what it feels like that scene, the end of that scene, is trying to do, which is to say that, like, this creature that's never lived on Earth maybe has a better way of appreciating life on Earth than people who are so inured to it, so into it, like, that they don't see it fresh. But I don't think the execution of it works at all, because if they'd taken the time to make what 22 is saying somehow misreadable, like if they'd made her lines something that you could take as philosophy or as like a bigger picture kind of thing, like if it had been misinterpretable as talking about how wonderful life is, or even if she'd just been generally talking about the wonders of life, that would have made sense. But she's talking very specifically about being like a 10,000-year-old soul that was mentored by Abraham Lincoln. And then you have all these characters standing around saying, oh, wow, man, we've all been there. No, you haven't. Like, there is no world in which somebody would take, I'm a 10,000-year-old soul who ticked off Gandhi, as, yeah, you know, that's so relatable. That's a symbol that's really relatable to my personal life, too. It just, she sounds like a crazy person, and she's acting hugely out of character for Joe at that moment. But the script requires everybody to just be like, oh, yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. And I just couldn't buy it, no matter how much I wanted to.
It really does, yeah, on reflection, seem like a really good argument against the movie. And I would imagine pretty central to the argument that you're making, Robert, in your piece, and a little bit on here too, about, because I think we can see that scene, and because, you know, we're seeing and hearing Joe in that barber chair we of course can forget, it masks the fact that no, that's not the person who's actually talking. That's not the person that we're actually hearing. That the actual voice, the one who's having this moment, these revelations, is 22, and that puts a way different inflection on the scene that the movie kind of craftily gets away with, because you know she's in the body of Joe.
Yeah, I also felt that way with the conversation between Joe and his mother. Right, that argument. And Joe kind of, you know, or I guess 22. It's weird, like, the way that scene is constructed, right? Where Joe's, like, finally going to give her a piece of her mind, of his mind. But it begins with him mouthing to 22. But then we see 22 as Joe speaking, but we don't see the cat meowing anymore. You're just like, is this coming from Joe or is this coming from 22? Because we get the sense that unconsciously that 22 feels exactly what Joe is feeling and has the baggage of Joe, right? And I guess in some way can speak to everything that, you know, he's wanted to speak to. But it's still just, there's something that logically doesn't work there for me, that, you know, how that is executed just doesn't work of like, okay, well, who's talking?
Yeah, it actually took me a moment to remember that it was 22 speaking, because I guess the idea there is that 22 has merged her, you know, I guess you can't even really say her because it's supposed to be an indeterminate soul, but merged their thoughts with his so thoroughly that they understand him. But, you know, I don't know. I think I'm not sure it quite works.
I mean, the lead up to the scene, I think, makes it very clear that anytime Joe is talking in the body of the cat, people hear yowling from the cat. And we have to just erase that for that scene to work. But yeah, I did find myself thinking, like, is his mom noticing that as he's like delivering this like heartfelt monologue where he bares his soul to her for the first time in forever, like the entire time there's this cat standing on his shoulder yowling? you would think she'd be like, this is a very important conversation to have. First, we're putting the tan cat out.
That stuff is comic gold to me every time too, when you hear that cat like, mewling like that. That, like, just the actual cat behavior is pretty funny in the movie.
We're running super long on Soul, but before we move on, I do want to kind of shout out the look of this movie, which we haven't talked about much at all. It really was the Great Before that sold me on it originally. The counselors and their weird sort of Picasso Hirschfeld kind of look, and their strange, like, barely two-dimensionality, and they're morphing into different shapes, and just they're inhumanity. They're like friendly but completely alien inhumanity. But like the second time around, particularly, there's just that scene where Joe's sitting in the doorway, like looking up through the fall leaves with the light falling in his face, like when it's 22 in his body, and he's having that realization of just like, hey, life on Earth is cool. Whether the moment works for you or not, it just feels like one of Pixar's loveliest images to date, like in a long series of lovely images. There's just a lot in this film that's really visually beautiful, regardless of any other concerns.
It's yet another – every movie we see is a pandemic movie, and this is a pandemic movie. And it says, because it gets at all of the communal, you know, urban experiences that you just miss so badly, you know, of being able to, you know, convene with people in a barbershop, to be able to have a slice of pizza, for God's sakes. I mean, imagine even that, and to just be out and about with other people, and to be out into the world, and to see its best face in a lot of ways too. I mean, it's just a very beautiful, optimistic, you know, understanding of New York that's quite appealingly rendered.
Every movie now is making me miss the world. The longer this goes on, and the deeper we get into winter, and yeah, yes, it is like there. So many things like feel like accident. Anything that like celebrates the everyday existence now feels like an accidental pandemic movie. It feels like a movie that's kind of made with what we're going through in mind, you know, to taunt us and torture us or whatever.
For sure. Well, we have talked quite a bit through Soul. We want to bring Powell and Pressburger back. So we'll be right back after this break to talk about the connections between Soul and A Matter of Life and Death.
Hang on. What are y'all laughing at? So Connie got a little lost in it. That's a good thing. Look, I remember one time my dad took me to this jazz club, and that's the last place I wanted to be. But then I see this guy, and he's playing these chords with force on it. And then with a minor, I was, whoa, whoa, whoa. Then he has the inner voices, and it's like he's singing. And I swear, the next thing I know, it's like he floats off the stage. That guy was lost in the music. He was in it. And he took the rest of us with him. That's when I knew I was born to play.
So now it's time for connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. And surely Pete Docter and company have seen the film A Matter of Life and Death. And one of the things that, one of the real one-to-one connections between the two movies is the fact that there's something wrong with the bureaucracy here. There's a flaw, there's an error in an otherwise perfect system. Someone is missing from the ledger. A soul is unaccounted for. So I kind of wanted to get into that a little bit and talk about the idea of afterlife bureaucracy in both of these films. So what do you think, Tasha?
I think there are 1,000 different things here we could talk about in terms of comparing the afterlife bureaucracy of these movies. One of the biggest ones being that the bureaucracy in Soul seems to be entirely warm and welcoming. Like the bureaucracy is about making sure that these souls like have their purpose and are their spark or whatever you want to call it, and that they're prepared in some way for life on Earth. It seems all of the colors are very warm. The counselors are very parentally. There's just an overall air of caring and concern. Although the counselor Jerry, a bunch of them are named Counselor Jerry. The Counselor Jerry, voiced by Alice Braga, is kind of interesting in her like arbitrariness about giving people personalities. There is just sort of that aspect of, you know, you batch over there, you can all be aloof. You batch over there, you can all be incurious. Like assigning people horrible personality traits in some cases on just seeming like a whim. But overall, it seems to be like a warm and nurturing place, I guess. Whereas the bureaucracy in Matter of Life and Death just seems so cold and clinical, and they're willing to let themselves be swayed by love eventually. Like they're willing to actually give love its day in court. But most of what we see of it is very businesslike, very interested in shutting out any form of human emotion. And you don't get the impression that these people are very human or humanoid at all. It's a little unclear whether they're angels or whether they're, it sort of sounds like they're people who passed on but chose to hang out and be bureaucrats. There's a lot that we don't know about the bureaucracy in Matter of Life and Death, and none of it is necessarily all that promising about like what actually happens after you die. There's the vague snippet of information about how everybody's being trained for another world, but we don't know anything about what that means. In the same way, we don't really know what happens when people in Soul go into the giant celestial bug zapper in the sky, which I actually found pretty creepy. People's acquiescence to it, I found, in a way, even creepier. So, but both of these bureaucracies.
Nice. I mean, wait a minute. Wait, you wouldn't want to go up to a nice
bug zapper?
See a stars? I mean,
we see people like,
I didn't think
losing,
it was a bug zapper.
We see people losing their identities, and then we get a literal bug zapper sound effect as they zorch into non-being.
Oh my God.
I don't know what else you would call that. But that's as maybe. I get the one other thing I want to point out about these bureaucracies is that both of them make reference that in both cases they lose a soul, and in both cases somebody says, "Well, we can't have lost a soul. That hasn't happened in a really long time," which means that both of these bureaucracies have previously lost souls, and that they're both pretty cavalier about the possibility of error. You know, they're just dismissive of the idea. Well, we haven't messed up in a long time, so we couldn't possibly have messed up now. But there's no, like, we've never lost a soul. It's just like, no, that hasn't happened in 600 years, so it can't have happened here. And I think it's interesting that there's flaws, like, built into the backstory of both of these systems, as well as kind of flaws in the personality of the people running them.
I would push back a little bit on your characterization of matter, life, and death. I do think it's ultimately the purposes are benevolent. I think maybe even, as you point out, maybe a little more obviously benevolent than what happens after death in a soul. But I do think that, you know, they're formal and they're brusque, but they, you know, it's ultimately toward pushing everyone toward heaven itself, which is, you know, despite our hero wanting a reprieve from that, it's not necessarily a bad place to be.
Well, let me ask you all this, leaving aside the people who do manage to escape it, leaving aside that the system in both cases is benevolent enough to give one person back their life, to give a protagonist back their life so the story can continue. Is there anything in either of these systems that you find comforting in a, like, that doesn't look like such a bad thing to happen to you after you die kind of way?
I mean, the bug zapper seemed pretty good to me. Yeah. I don't know what. I mean, that seemed fun.
I was okay with a Coca-Cola machine in the lobby.
It's a small pleasures for her. It's like, as long as there's a decent selection of, I guess now a more updated version would be like one of those machines that where you could just put it wherever you want. You just press a button. Maybe that would be
just like a freestyle machine dial up your drink.
Right, exactly. Those amaze me as an adult. Anyway.
You know where I used to enjoy those? At movie theaters.
Yeah, movie theaters. Yeah, well, there's no indication in either one of these movies that the theatrical experience is cherished at all. I don't like that.
I guess what's comforting about the afterlife and a matter of life and death is the fact that it's so familiar, right? Where it's, you know, soul is so abstract, right? But like, at least there's, you know, we see a matter of life and death. It feels like, oh yeah, that's, you know, it looks like a museum that they walk into, basically, and there's the lobby and everything, and then there's the angel wings, which is so, you know, the iconography of that, you know, and that being the images that it brings of, like, you know, oh, you're gonna float off into the sky or something like that. Yeah, I mean, I find that, and also the fact that, you know, people are dead, but, you know, it's some of them traumatically, as we can tell, because it, you know, it's set in World War II, right? But there are no scars on them, and they still look like themselves. You know, they still look like they are human, whereas, like, in Soul, they're just like blue blobs that, you know, might have an accent here or there.
I would say too that we're not given in either film a real full portrait of what the afterlife might actually be like. We're almost more in a way station in both. And this is something that also happens in a film I adore that Tasha famously does not, Defending Your Life, the Albert Brooks film, which takes place entirely in this kind of pleasant little purgatory where decisions are being made and some people are moved forward and some people have to go back to where they were. That's kind of where we are with both of these films. So we don't really get, you know, a sense of what the afterlife actually is in either case, you know, other than maybe getting a nice set of, you know, Walmart wings, I guess, when you get sent to heaven a matter of life and death.
But I mean, what does it say in both of these films? Is it just that people can't imagine any system that could move a lot of people through, like the necessary volume of people through, that isn't a bureaucracy? Is that why both of these films shape the afterlife the same way?
I think it's funny. I mean, it may be as simple as that. It may just be a funny contrast between what we expect of the great beyond or the great before, and, you know, how one might shape it. Also, maybe it's just sort of a nice bit of commentary on the limits of the human imagination that's as far as we can get. You know, we have to put it in the form of something that we recognize and tolerate.
Yeah, it is worth noting that the afterlife seems to be pretty bureaucracy-free, apart from the bean counter counting all the beans. Like, there's not really any interference with those people. They're just sort of expected to go up the staircase into the bug zapper, and that all the bureaucracy comes in the before. But it is interesting to me that both of these films portray, you know, what's outside human experience as one of our least beloved human experiences.
Hmm.
You know, I'm fascinated by the connection too between Soul and Inside Out in that bureaucratic thing where it's like eventually you just get down to massive filing systems. You know, like Inside Out, it's just this huge store of long-term memories, some of which are just zapped away forever and thrown into oblivion. But it is this unimaginable system, you know, or it's Soul, where it's this filing system where you're kind of going through, you know, A through Z for eternity to try to figure out, you know, who's missing. That's interesting. It's an interesting thought because it is of course it's a big job to try to process the dead. I mean, there's a lot of dead people. There's a lot of dead people coming through all the time. A lot of dead people that have been processed. You have to have a good system in place. And I guess that's it seemed like both of the systems here were pretty well worked out.
I mean, I think it is interesting that both of these films, while the bureaucracy itself may not show a whole lot of human imagination, the outside the life experience is where both films kind of get their meat and potatoes in terms of ambitious cinematography, ambitious imagery. You know, Powell's idea of a heaven that's also a spiral galaxy, that's also a place where there's a floor full of holes that you can just kind of like look down on the world. That's just a whole bunch of different things at once, depending on what it needs to be at any given time, I think is pretty interesting. And the sort of crash for the future in Soul, I think is equally interesting. Like, these are both people trying to very much imagine what comes outside mortal life and what something much bigger and cleaner would look like. And I think the visuals just become very interesting and important in both of these movies.
Well, one of the other connections between these two films is they can get right down to the essence, which is what is the meaning of life? What is the purpose of being alive? Because we have these two movies with protagonists who have broken the rules deliberately and go to great lengths to, you know, reject their fate and, you know, defy, you know, millennia of afterlife law to return to be mortal and to carry on with their lives. And so that's another kind of key connection between these two movies. No,
yeah, I'm not even sure. I mean, if so, it's weird because like Soul is trying to answer what Joe's purpose is, what, you know, and like the way they use his purpose and Spark, she was very ambiguous. It's never really like defined. We just kind of find out what it's not. We never find out what it is, right? And so like Soul is, I think, grappling with that, you know, the meaning of life, right? Maybe a little bit differently, where like 22 is incredulous, right, about Joe wanting to go back to his crappy life that he hates, like, but still, like, you know, needs to, you know, wants to hold on to it, you know. Whereas like I feel in Matter of Life and Death, right, for like say Martyr's character, where he very much empathizes, right, he has lived, you know, he has had a life and can see why Niven's character would want to go back to his life, right? He knows, oh, there's love there. And I feel like it's so much, you know, quantifiable in A Matter of Life and Death as opposed to Soul.
I think they're both also ultimately about how the meaning of life is not in the sort of these grandiose beliefs or these big systems or national identity or in Soul in fulfilling your dreams. I think they're in much smaller things. Like, it's kind of like you've been looking in the wrong places and you'll find meaning at some place much, much closer to you, or something much more every day. If like falling in love, you know, a lot of people do it, but maybe it's ultimately the best thing there is. And with Soul, like sort of the elements of the humble pleasures of everyday life, which, you know, we talked about all missing very much, right now. You know, that's where it's at. I mean, I really do like the elements of Soul that are about him achieving his dreams and being left empty. Because, I mean, that's really, you know, in terms of achieving dreams, I don't know that I've had a grand dream that had to come true. But, you know, you think to yourself, if I can just get this accomplishment, then, you know, I'll feel great. You know, I've gotten there. And you never get there. You know, I remember seeing Jaime and Gilbert Hernandez, the creators of Love and Rockets, speak once. And, you know, you both on any short list of the greatest cartoonists, the most influential cartoonists of the last few years. And Gilbert was reflecting on being in a punk band and how they never had a great drummer. Green Day, who there was a contemporaries more or less, they had a great drummer. So this is someone who's like at the top of his field, and he's just reminiscing about, like, man, if I just had a drummer, I could have been a great, you know, I could have been as big as Green Day. It's like, yeah, you just don't get there, and you don't see that expressed in films, which are very much, you know, a lot of plots are driven about, you know, hero achieves goal, roll credits, and that's just a different kind of ending. And I'm not sure it totally sticks it all the way, but it's a really interesting, it's a bold choice.
Yeah, I feel like something distinctive between these two movies here is the degree to which A Matter of Life and Death kind of says, well, we're in love right now, and therefore, and that's it. Like, that's all we need. That's more powerful than life and death itself. It's more powerful than any bureaucracy. But it's literally been less than 24 hours for them. Like, I wonder what that relationship looks like in a week. I wonder what that relationship looks like in a year. I wonder if that relationship is still there in a year. We know that Peter's going to survive longer than that, unless the Heaven's bureaucracy was getting really, really huffy over a 6-month extension. But I feel like what Soul is doing is not necessarily saying, hey, a musical career isn't fulfilling, or hey, creating isn't fulfilling, or hey, getting your dreams isn't fulfilling. What I feel like it's saying, which strikes me as the kind of message that the movies hate, but the kind of message that we all need to hear a little more often, is that life is about living, like every day, getting up and doing the work, you know, doing the work of getting out of bed and brushing your teeth and making food. And whether you're doing work, you got to scrub the toilet today, like whatever it is, it just goes on. And you can meet your soulmate and fall in love, but you still have to do the daily work. You can get the job you've always wanted, but you still have to do the daily work. You can meet the celebrity that you think is going to be the apotheosis of your dreams if you finally meet them, or accomplish whatever goal, get your first novel published, cliff dive in Borneo, like whatever it is. And then you still have to do the work. And I feel like Soul acknowledging that movies just end with a happily ever after a lot of the time. And the assumption is, and the story does not continue, and you don't have to deal with the messiness of life. So what Soul is saying is, and then you got to get up and do it again. And it's just not a satisfying conclusion, but it's such a real conclusion. It's such an honest conclusion. And maybe honesty isn't the most, like, neatly narrative satisfying thing there is in the world, but I really kind of love that we have a movie that says it.
Get to Pete Doctor's career too. I mean, the message of sorts in Soul is, you know, quite similar to Up, in that Up is about a character or characters who, you know, Carl and Ellie, who want to go on this adventure to Paradise Falls in South America, and of course in that very heartbreaking montage that opens the film, they never make it because there's a lot of setbacks. Like, they can't have children. It's a very sad thing. And of course, then the rest of the film, you know, is about this quite whimsical adventure where Carl and this stowaway boy kind of do, you know, fly up in this balloon and do make it to Paradise Falls. And it takes getting to Paradise Falls to realize that was not really the point, you know, in that there were other things that were more important about life and other things that were more meaningful about, you know, Carl's relationship with Ellie. And that was something that Ellie had understood that Carl needed to go on this adventure himself to understand. And so I think that's kind of a thing, kind of just a doctor philosophy that's being kind of played out in both, you know, Up and now this movie, that the meaning of life is life. It's not a goal that you achieve, and that if you attach too much to achieving that, to achieving a goal, that you're liable to find that to be an empty and disappointing experience.
One other connection is these are both films rooted in a particular time and place. We get Southern England in A Matter of Life and Death, but I think it's kind of a stand-in for England in general. It certainly gets some of the most beautiful parts of England in this film, and the beaches and the fields, but also you get the British character. And I think we touched on it before. It's kind of like the most glowing stereotype of the British character. It's just sort of the stiff upper lip and then the ironic humor, but also the strong values and ultimately good nature. Though certainly in the trial sequence, the ways that nature has the goodness of that nature is certainly put on trial in some ways. In Seoul, we get New York culture, and as particularly as a vibrant, multicultural place filled with music and food and bustle and people who have some conflicts aside have learned to live with one another. You bump into someone in the subway and they yell at you, but the system basically works. So I think they're similar in some ways. I think they're both sort of like love letters to these places that kind of acknowledge some of their flaws. Does everyone else feel the same way?
I think, A Matter of Life and Death, what I find interesting is the trial sequence where we get these, we've had this entire film where, it's like the picturesque kind of, Britain. But like one of the things that gets brought against Britain is, its imperialistic history as being like one of the lack of a better term, the grimer portions of being British, right? Of like, well, you've taken advantage of all these people, and that's where you partly get your cheeriness from, on the backs of others. And with regards to New York, it being just this melting pot of people being crap to you, but that's like okay because like it's character building. But I find that the things that A Matter of Life and Death bringing up, like especially with regards to imperialism and especially with regards to Britain's place on the world stage during World War II and how it's still somewhat elevated before the upstart Americans kind of like take over and admonish Britain for its past, only to, as we know, kind of repeat those same mistakes in the future, to be quite subversive. That something I wasn't expecting to confront in that film.
I can't think of an American studio film from that era that was quite as frank. If that motive is fleeting, it's still pretty cutting. I can't think of an American film that's quite as frank about the flaws of our country from that period.
At the same time, like it's that explication of the jury is so cutting and so emotional and in a way so daring and unusual. But the whole time it was going on, I was thinking, but what's the relevance here? Like we're trying to set up a court case that amounts to nobody could love a Brit. Like that you two can't be in love. And it just feels so distanced from the emotional core of the movie, which is about these two people and not about a national referendum. All of the national referendum stuff in A Matter of Life and Death, I thought was very odd.
Well, I think some of that comes from, as we touched on before, mm-hmm. sort of the tensions between the United States and Britain at the time, too, and a place that was suddenly flooded with all these people who joined the war a little bit later than everybody else, and then kind of like filled up the country and were romancing the women and so on and so forth. So, that may not read as immediate to us now. I wouldn't call it dated, though. but I think a little cultural context kind of helps explain that a little bit better.
Oh, sure. It's just it's as if Seoul like took a 20-minute downtime to get away from Joe and 22 and their relationship to talk about like Korean Japanese relationships in the 1940s, like at length. It's just it feels like it's a history lesson and an explication of like a bunch of different aspects of culture. But again, like, what's the relevance to the story you're telling?
Oh, yeah. It like has zero relevance other than you shouldn't fall in love with Brits, you know? but yeah, no, it definitely is something that feels very, I don't know what to say, dated, but apart from what we're used to of the post like special relationship, you know, between the two countries. That's almost, it seemed like it's always existed, but it's really very much a recent phenomenon, but it has been around long enough during our lifetimes that it feels sort of out of the way to explicate and go through the fissures that are happening between these two countries. And once again, you know, the U.S. coming in late after years of UK being bombed to death, literally, you know, and begging, please help us, and us being like, oh, well, we'll see.
It also just, I guess it feels a little weird as a plot point because, you know, in the modern world, we're used to thinking of Britain as one of our closest allies and the people who are probably worldwide culturally closest to us, as we've become, you know, at least slightly more awake and aware of other countries and religions and traditions and just people in general. The idea that, you know, two English-speaking white people could not possibly be able to get along, as opposed to the 100,000 variants on Romeo and Juliet that we've had of people from, like, actually opposing countries, like, for factions or races or belief systems or what have you, like whatever barriers that we find between people and have found in movies, finding a barrier between Brits and Americans just strikes me as it feels a little odd in this day and age.
I'm also reminded of the central conflict in The Crown, the abdication, right, where it is the English king who gets with the American woman, and you know, the British society is very incredulous on their love. Like, how can these two people possibly love each other? how can our great king be into this cloying American woman? I wonder if there's some, you know, if there's some residue of that on that relationship.
Though I would say, I think that the union, I guess, of Peter and June is forged here with optimism about the future of this relationship. No, I mean, this is
I would positive. Say only someone with no romantic feeling in their soul whatsoever could not be moved by this relationship. What do you think, Tasha?
I think I've already confessed to being moved by this relationship, and as with
that's true.
So okay. Many other things, liking something slightly less than you do and in a slightly different way than you do has turned me into a human monster. But you know, I think that there are different ways to appreciate things. I think that both of these films have just inherently really interesting, big, ambitious ideas and slightly flawed executions. And it's much as with Defending Your Life, which I'll go three around the mulberry bush with Scott on that one any day.
No, it's so great.
You have a brilliant idea and you can see ways that it could be better. It's hard to not think about the ways it could be better.
Oh God! Oh no! Yeah, we can't do it. We can't do this. We can't do this. And we're not going to do this because I'm hosting the show. We're going to move past connections and say that A Matter of Life and Death is on Criterion DVD and Blu-ray, which is what Defending Your Life will be in March. By the way, it's not streaming anywhere officially, but it's also up in a half decent form on YouTube. You know, we can't necessarily recommend you watch films that way, but you know, it's there. Soul is currently a Disney Plus exclusive. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we recommend, especially in this age of widely available digital media that we all need to catch up on. We call it your next picture show, in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar Tasha, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
We should really cut the lately part out of these recommendations, because sometimes we reach back further into things that just seem really appropriate. So thematically, I would love to spend this time going on and on about Kurita's movie Afterlife and how much I love it. It's really literally one of my all-time favorite movies. And it's another movie about afterlife bureaucracy and about the process of what happens after you die. It would just be such a great triple feature with these movies. Unfortunately, it's basically unavailable. You can buy a DVD or Blu-ray copies of it, a little on the pricey side. I'm not even sure it's in print. They're just, you know, available. But it doesn't seem to be streaming anywhere, which is a real shame because it's lovely and because there's a movie coming out theoretically in 2021 that's a perfect bookend for it. And I absolutely wanted to do these as a double. I don't know why Kurita's movies are so hard to find in the US. Mm-hmm. And I would like that to change. Since I cannot in good conscience tell people you need to drop everything and go see this movie that you can only see by buying it on physical media, I'll bring up something else that's an afterlife story, probably the most unconventional of the many afterlife movies I've seen. It's called Wrist Cutter's A Love Story, and it's from 2006. I'm not going to claim that it's a great movie. It's a distinctly weird movie. It's based on Edgar Corret's writing. He's a short story writer primarily that's it just produces some really amazing, offbeat, unusual kind of stuff. And in this particular case, it's a sort of love story about the world that people go to when they commit suicide. So it's a dark sort of comedy romance kind of story about a couple stuck in this, again, kind of afterlife way station-y sort of place that they describe as exactly like the living world, except everything is crappier. It's got a pretty incredible cast. Will Arnett, Nick Offerman, Amy Simetz, Zira Skye, Shea Whigham, Patrick Fugit, just all sorts of people, Leslie Bibb. But if you're watching it, you're probably watching it in part for Tom Waits, who's just the biggest hoot in this film. It is one of those movies that you end up kind of loving, not because it's the best story that you've ever seen, but because it's a story you've never seen before. You're not going to see anything else like it. And I wasn't head over heels for it when it came out. I was just like, this is just a very strange offbeat, kind of, the kind of indie that you get out of some very weird people following their very weird muse. But the movie has just stuck with me over the years. Like it's offbeat humor and it's outsized performances and it's just really distinctiveness in a lot of different ways. And it's, unlike Afterlife, very widely available, including on all the major streaming services, including Amazon Prime Video. It's free if you've already got that service. So if you're in the mood for something weird and a little on the dark side and you don't mind a film that, I'm not going to say it's a downer ending per se, but it's certainly a downer premise. Wrist Cutter's A Love Story. It's going to be one of the weirder films you watch about life and death and the meaning of life.
Has anyone seen that one besides Tasha?
I haven't.
Yeah, me neither. So gosh, I guess we need to catch up. I had heard, you know, that did seem to kind of have a kind of instant cult appeal, that movie. Or at least a hoped for cult appeal.
Yeah, I mean, anyway, if nothing else, it's just got kind of that the cachet of a movie that talks about things that movies generally don't talk about. You know, suicide is a horrible, depressing topic, and movies tend to either like milk it for big, deep drama or not acknowledge it at all. So a movie that takes a lighter tone with it without being like dismissive or flippant or thinking that it's edgy to bring up is just an interesting thing. But speaking of movies that we all need to get caught up on, Robert, what's your recommendation?
My recommendation is the other Kemp Powers written film, One Night at Miami, which is Regina King's feature directorial debut. It happens literally over the course of one night in a Miami hotel room. It's based on a loosely based on a real event, though, you know, the particulars are made up a little bit, particularly the conversations that they have, but it's probably between four of the biggest black 60s cultural icons, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown. And they meet over the course of one night in a hotel room, and they talk about black liberation and how the process of getting there. And they talk about each person's personal failings and how, you know, they haven't quite maybe lived up to their particular talents or their particular drive or purpose. However, you know, it sounds like a pretty dour film, but it's actually, you know, the script is incredibly snappy. It's very, very, very funny. Aldis Hodge is in it as Jim Brown. He has some of the best one-liners probably of his career. I rewatched it last night. There are parts of it, in every joke that's in there held up on the second watch. And every, like, you know, punch the air moment also held up. Kingsley Benadire's in it too. So is Eli Goree and Leslie Odom Jr. Leslie Odom Jr. and, or I should say, Eli Goree and Kingsley Benadire have the toughest tasks. The latter is playing Malcolm X, the former's playing Muhammad Ali, two people who've already had very big cinematic adaptions done to them. But however, I do think the way that they're able to carve out those characters are incredibly unique and quite different from the other portrayals that we're kind of used to seeing. It's a strongly acted ensemble. It's a, you know, well-decorated period piece. And yeah, it's overall just a fun time. It's a film that has a lot of rewatch value. It's coming on Amazon Prime January 15th. And yeah, highly, highly, highly recommend it.
I just got my screener for that like 2 days ago. I don't know why it came so late, but yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. The early reviews for it, I don't remember what festival that was out of, but the early reviews for it were really over the moon.
It was at Toronto, debuted at Venice, and then it was at Toronto. But it's played just about, I think it's played just about every place that has a festival.
And I just, Regina King, I'm just so excited for her career and all the places it seems to be going. What's she like as a stylist? Like, what stood out to you about the direction?
So I think the best part of the direction is probably the performances she's able to get from the actors. I think to open, and I hate, you know, being like saying TV direction, because we, as we already know, the bound, you know, the barriers between those is getting looser and looser and looser. But I think compositionally to open, it's a little too repetitive, a little too, you know, one shot cut, this person speaks, one shot cut, you know. And I don't think it opens up enough until maybe about 30 minutes in when, or not even 30 minutes in, maybe 25 minutes or 20 minutes in when all four of the actors are together, because it kind of begins where she's charting where each character is in their respective life, and then they come together. And I don't think it's until then when she has four people and she's kind of forced to do, you know, more interesting compositions, you know, more like two shot, four shot, three shot, that it doesn't feel, because it's, I should note that it is adapted from Kent Powers' play of the same name, right? So it feels, in this early going, feels kind of stagey and a little bit too inert visually. But I think it very much opens up later on. And I think stylistically, you know, it's become much more glossier and just much more vibrant, too. I think her direction really comes alive, you know, but after that first act.
So, Keith, how about you?
So I've got another, I mean, I mentioned before, I'm kind of fond of such films, you know, other supernatural themed comedies from this era and other eras too. But you know, beyond a matter of life and death, well, a film you might, if you enjoy it, you might also enjoy a similarly themed film in some ways called Here Comes Mr. Jordan, which stars Robert Montgomery as a boxer who dies in a plane accident, but is determined to be taken too soon, so he has to return to life in somebody else's body. The twist here being that it's somebody who has just been murdered by his wife and one of his work, one of the people who works for him. So it's a fun film. It's got a nice romance in the center of it. Claude Rains plays the eponymous Mr. Jordan, who is sort of the heavenly supervisor You know, it's very enjoyable. You know, perhaps not as concerned with the big questions as a matter of life and death, but quite fun in its way. It's been remade several times. Most famously as Heaven Can Wait, starring Warren Beatty, and then again as Down Earth, starring Chris Rock. I love the Warren Beatty one. I haven't seen the Chris Rock one. Has anyone seen Down Earth, the Chris Rock version of this?
I have. It's not so great.
I've blotted it from my memory. I've seen it too.
Okay. Well,
not so great.
It's a venerable premise in other hands, I guess, but certainly in this one. So it's definitely worth your time. That's also not streaming on the Criterion channel, although there's a Criterion edition of it, but it is rentable on other platforms. Scott, how about you?
So I had occasion. I mean, I've talked before about how I think 2020 was a really good year for documentaries. I saw a lot of really fine documentaries that did find their way onto streaming services. And one of those that I don't think got talked about enough was the Norwegian documentary, The Painter and the Thief. This is a film about the relationship between a Czech artist named Barbara Kieselova and a man named Carl Bertil Nordlund, who is one of two crooks who was caught stealing two of her paintings from an Oslo art gallery in 2015. During the trial, this almost sounds like a Seinfeld premise or something, the artist Kieselkova persuaded Nordlund to sit for a portrait, and their collaboration is captured in the movie, and then his reaction to seeing what she has done, how she has rendered him, is just one of the most galvanizing moments I've seen in movies this year. His reaction to it is so powerful, because here is somebody who is a ne'er-do-well, a career criminal, who is being seen in a very interesting and profound and transformative light. But the story doesn't really end there. They have a relationship that ends up being quite complicated and troubled, and has almost and plays to both of their tendencies toward codependency, towards self-destructiveness. So there's a whole lot of twists and turns involved too, all captured on camera. It's a very unusual movie. It's very unexpected. And there's a lot there psychologically to unpack. It's on Hulu for if you have that service, so you can find it. You can rent it elsewhere. But I quite recommend it. It's called The Painter and the Thief.
Scott, there aren't many people I could ask this, but when I read the description of that movie, my first thought was that it felt like a different country's take on Kiarostami's Close Up, which is also about identity theft and art and like exploring the psyche of the person who would...
No. How did I miss that?
Yeah,
no, that...
So was it similar in your eyes?
Yes. No, that's a really good point. My God, I think that's correct. I think that those that if we were to do, if we've already done Close Up, what did we do Close Up with?
Well, we didn't do Close Up. We did Moment of Innocence.
No, we did Close Up on the show.
Did we?
Did Close Up on the show.
Moment of Innocence was a movie of the week.
Keith's shameless SEO. as editor in chief, it's like, let's devote a whole week to Mohsen Makhmalbaf's A Moment of Innocence and our juggernaut of a film site. But no, what did we pair Close Up with on this show, though? Do you remember?
I have never actually seen the movie, so if we did it, I wasn't here for it.
Yeah, I think you might not have been. But
we have listeners who know this.
We'll figure it out.
Screaming at their microphones right now.
I know. Yeah, of course they remember everything. So that's a good comparison. It does have a little. I wish it almost had more of a feeling of a Kiarostami film, where because I think you do kind of question the filmmaker's role here in a way that Kiarostami would have just revealed all of that. He would have revealed. His presence would not have tried to kind of hide it too much.
The writer. We paired it with The Writer.
Huh. Oh, right. Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, that was a good one. Who could forget? Who could forget that episode? That's it for this edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next pairing will come out January 19th and 26th. Keith, what do we have on tap?
On our next episodes of The Next Picture Show, we'll be watching movies featuring men who drink, a lot. Maybe too much, or maybe just the right amount. It's hard to tell, especially through a haze of alcohol. First up, we'll be revisiting Alexander Payne's 2004 comedy Sideways, in which Paul Giamatti and Thomas Hayden Church play characters taking a tour of California wine country, a journey involving a little bit of reflection and a lot of poor decisions. Then we'll talk about Another Round, the latest film from Danish director Thomas Vinterberg. Mads Mikkelsen stars as one of four school teachers who decide the cure for middle-aged doldrums might lie in maintaining a steady buzz throughout the day. What could possibly go wrong? Join us as we find out.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of A Matter of Life and Death, Soul, or anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Tasha Robinson.
I am the film and TV editor at Polygon.com. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. Keith?
I'm a freelance writer. You can find me on Twitter at KFIPS3000. I write for places like Vulture, The Ringer, Polygon sometimes, a bunch of other places too, GQ, whatever. I'll write for you if you want me to write for you. KFIPS3000. I post most of my links to my writing there.
No fee is too big, right?
Some fees are too small. That's true. but my definition of small is pretty generous. Robert, how about you?
Yes, you can find me at 812 Film Reviews on Twitter. I freelance regularly for Polygon, which should have a piece on Soul coming out somewhat soonish. See in the future, very near future, I'll be covering Sundance. I think I'm covering the World Doc competition for RogerEbert.com for Sundance.
Yeah, there was, I think it was like Robert Redford. It was like, if you want to see a good movie at Sundance, just go see documentaries. So you're probably in a pretty good shape. And as for myself, I'm on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. And you can find my work in the New York Times. You can find it in The Ringer, Guardian, Vulture, and other fine publications. I'm also the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope's Musings blog. Our producer and co-host, Genevieve Kosky. You can find her at Genevieve Kosky on Twitter. She is the deputy TV editor for Vulture. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at Next Picture Pod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. You can also contribute to our Patreon and get bonus content at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. If you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thank you, Robert, for being with us. I did not get a chance to say that. That was great. We love having special guests, and you are no exception. We're not going to. We love you like we have loved our other special guests. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Dan the Bake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.